The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Those of you who have been coming the last two Sundays know that I've been talking about the Four Noble Truths. And in a sense, I'd like to continue that today by talking about the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path is sometimes presented as one of the key ways to understand the process of practice or the path of practice in Buddhism. And there are actually many ways in which Buddhism, down through the ages, has tried to organize or categorize or describe a process of spiritual growth, development, and freedom. And the Eightfold Path is just one of them. And the Eightfold Path shouldn't be taken as being some very sharp, definitive steps that you go through, but rather some people say it's like eight strands of a rope that they go together to make a strong rope. And there are other ways of formulating the path besides the Eightfold Path, so you don't have to stick to that. But I like the Eightfold Path because it allows for a variety of different ways of understanding that inner process that we engage in. So I want to try to offer one, maybe a little different perspective on the process of the Eightfold Path. And then I thought if I do a decent job presenting it today, then perhaps next week I can kind of review a little bit, and then next week maybe it can be a good time for questions and answers and discussion about it as well. So I'm thinking a little bit of the Eightfold Path of being somewhat analogous to being born and then growing up. That when you're first born, you are helpless. Pretty much. I got that helpless. I mean, I guess that helpless scream is actually very well engineered to get a certain result. But in any case, so there's a lot that the baby can't do for him or herself. And so there's a community of people that support and take care of the baby. And then as a child grows, it's slowly, step by step, the child's able to take care of more things alone. And at some point is able to go to the bathroom alone, some point able to feed herself alone, some point able to walk alone, some point able to go to school alone, take the bus alone, go out in the neighborhood alone without the parents hovering over. And then some point able to leave home entirely and go off and start a life someplace. And then at some point, completely independent of their parents, living independently. And so it's a process of discovering a certain degree of independence. And so in the same way, the Eightfold Path can be understood as explaining a little bit that process, that process of allowing people to discover something really, a potential that's there. The baby that's born has a tremendous potential, and sometimes people ooh and ah over the baby, and they have blessing ceremonies. And one of the things that happens in blessing ceremonies, people sometimes anticipate or imagine the potential that's inherent in the child, and they wish it for them. They hope that that child becomes happy in the future. And it's part of the role of parents in the community to hold the potential the child has and hold it a little bit, I would say, kind of sacred, but hold it as very special and very important, and try their best to help create the conditions that support the best potential to come forth. The potential of goodness and happiness and compassion, empathy, a lot of different things. And it's so easy to have other potentials come forth. So I know plenty of parents in our circles who don't really like to have their children watch television because it seems to that the violence and the various things that come through television support certain conditions for a certain potential to come forth that's not necessarily so advantageous or so helpful. Some of the messages of consumerism are not so helpful in the long run. And there's been a lot of really well-meaning parents, including myself, who didn't really understand all the aspects of what the impact of our well-meaning has. And so one example, that has been people are writing about now is how the self-esteem movement for children has backfired. And now there's a lot of children who think that they deserve everything, and it should come easy. They're really smart, they're wonderful, they're esteemed, And so think life should be relatively easy to the, for them. And then they come to college or something and they realize that maybe it's not so easy, that maybe they're not the best in their class. It's very depressing because they were held up so high, or you're so great. And so it becomes quite a challenge. And so I think people are shying away from the self-esteem kind of approach. Even though it seems like self-esteem should be, you know, is inherently a really good thing. So what I'm trying to say is that there's wonderful potential in a child, and there's a job to kind of foster what's the best potential, as opposed to the worst potential. We don't want to end up having, criminal on our hands growing up. That happens sometimes. And I'm very touched by Thich Nhat Hanh, who when the boat people were leaving Vietnam, the refugees, and some of them went astray and ended up off some of the Thai coast, and some of the pirates would sometimes capture and kill and rape, steal from the boat people. He said, if I grew up in their conditions, in their poverty and their situation, I think I would be a pirate as well. You know, here's someone who's basically kind of a saint-like person. And he said, well, given different conditions, I'd end up differently. So it's kind of a sacred task of a community, of a society, to foster the best, and to see the best, have a sense of the best in a child. So the Eightfold Path in Buddhism begins with right view. And part of right view is to have a sense of a potential that human beings have, that we have. And the stronger and more visceral that sense of potential can be, the more we can kind of try to support that and let the conditions be there to let that potential come out of us. But also there are other people around us who represent that potential, show that it's possible, have attained it to some degree. Other people who can point it out, say, look, there's this potential you have. You don't have to always be miserable. You don't have to always suffer and be upset and be angry and be aversive, and you don't have to always be confused. But it's possible to infuse your life with a tremendous sense of meaning and purpose, direction. And it's a direction that speaks to something that's inherent in your own heart, some potential you have. And so in Buddhism, that potential is described sometimes in different ways. And some of the more kind of some of the ways it's talked about in terms of spiritual qualities, it's talked about as the awakening of peace, tremendous peace, discovery of great happiness, mahasukha, the discovery or the awakening of compassion, of love, the discovery of a sense of liberation. So, to have a sense of this and to realize that they're important and valuable, as opposed to some of the other messages we get in society, the other orientations, is a really important part of this Eightfold Path. So the right view is to have really a sense of that potential, that possibility. And then to begin to orient yourself on that possibility. And there's no moral obligation to do this, but if you're interested in the Eightfold Path, that's what it begins with, is an orientation. The right view could also be described as right orientation. You begin orienting your life, organizing your life around this potential and this possibility. So you have a sense that this is important and I really want to take it up. There are plenty of people who might have some sense of its importance, but for whatever the forces that are in their lives prevent them from really taking it seriously, getting involved in it, really following through on it. They might abstractly think, oh, this is important to become free of my suffering, to cultivate love and peace, to develop the capacities to enter into my society and be of service. But they never get behind it. They never, or is it because of fear or because of other things that seem more important, or a variety of things. So to have a sense of the possibility, and the way that possibility is most commonly described in Buddhism is that it's the possibility of freedom from suffering. And in order to understand that possibility, you also have to understand something about what the causes and conditions for suffering are. And so you have to kind of be willing to understand and stop and really look and be very honest about the suffering you have. Without some honesty or clarity about that, it's a little bit hard to understand the depth of that potential to be free of suffering, the depth of peace or liberation that's there. And so so there's an emphasis in Buddhism of understanding the potential and understanding what stands in the way of it. And this to me is a very important point, because a potential is partly seen as an ideal. And it's very easy to become overly idealistic and lose track of what's happening here and now, because you're blinded by the ideal. And a healthy spirituality in Buddhism prefers to look at what's actually going on than looking at the ideal. The ideal is important, that's what I said today. The potential is important. But you don't want to be blinded by it so much you don't really stop and really take an honest look at what stands in the way of the potential. And partly that's because it's a dropping away of the obstacles that partly allows the potential to grow and develop. And so there tends to be a very positive view of human nature in Buddhism, because it says if the obstacles fall away, something beautiful begins to shine. The beautiful, pure heart can shine more and more. So we have this potential, and perhaps when the person first encounters the Eightfold Path, they're like a baby. And so they need to be nourished, needs to be taken care of. And then slowly, as we proceed through the Eightfold Path, it's a path where we slowly begin centering ourselves or cultivating a path that puts us into the very heart of where liberation, freedom, or autonomy, or independence can be found. But in Buddhism, at least, you're not often encouraged to jump into that automatically. If you're a baby, you're not asked, you're not given the car keys right away. Though sometimes I wished I could do that here. There you go. And so you kind of create the right causes and conditions to allow something to develop and happen. So then, in the Eightfold Path schema, the second of the Eightfold Path is usually called right intention or right attitude. And this means that if you're going to do something that has profound meaning, do something that speaks to some of the most sacred potential or most valuable potential that you have, it actually helps if you approach it with a respectful attitude, with a particular attitude, the best you can. And I know that some people will think, well, to change your attitude is insincere. I just be myself. But I think in many situations in life, we do change our attitude quite naturally. It's appropriate. Who we are is in part in relationship to our environment. And so we don't just show up. You know, if you're the only one who spoke, if you invented your own language and said, well, I'm just going to speak my own language, it's meaningless. It's pointless. To have your own language is basically, the point of language is to communicate with other people. And so you cultivate language and develop language in relationship to others. We develop, partly who we are is in relationship to our world and others. And so it's normal to change our attitude accordingly. You go to a funeral, you adjust your attitude. It's maybe pretty natural, but you don't, skip down the aisle with whistling Dixie. Though that might be a beautiful thing to do in other situations. Most people, if they enter into a preschool classroom, they change their attitude. Certain things you don't talk about, certain ways, if you're upset about the vote in Nevada, you don't go into a preschool and start kind of spouting about, this and that, and lobbyists and whatever. You kind of change what you talk about even in the preschool setting. It's quite common in many, many, many spiritual traditions that when you enter into the tradition, you should do so with a certain degree of respect. It's epitomized, I think, in the Japanese traditions where you have the ways, the daos, the do, like aikido and judo. And you come to study with a master who's going to impart something, and you have to first kind of demonstrate you come with a certain degree of sincerity and respect. And without demonstration of respect, the feeling of the teacher is that you're not really a recipient. You're not a vehicle to receive what's special. You're not a vehicle to receive this very special thing that I've trained myself to develop. And so it needs to be some show of respect in order to receive what you're going to get. And so I think some degree here in America, that sense of respect and care, of adjusting ourselves so we can receive something, is not so common for a variety of different reasons. And some people, if they study Japanese martial arts, that's one of the first things you learn. You come into the dojo, and the first thing maybe you do is you get down on your knees and you bow. So in Buddhism as well, there's a certain kind of attitude that's helpful to kind of see if you can, the best, in a sincere way, to adjust and make yourself in order to begin this path of engaging something profound. And so that orientation, that, I mean, that attitude is usually described in three ways. Two ways, how to say it, in a negative and a positive way. Negative means that you put aside the attitudes that you might have that are driven by sensual desire, that are driven by ill will, and driven by cruelty. Ill will and cruelty are considered a little bit different. You'll see in a moment why. So to put those aside and instead develop the opposite of those. Try to cultivate or come forth with the opposite attitudes. And usually the opposite of sensual desire is usually described in the tradition by renunciation. And I think of that as a broader term that means a willingness to be a little bit simple, to let go, to enter into kind of with empty hands, kind of sort of the classic Zen story that you probably all know. It's worth saying again. The academic, like a magician, comes to the Zen master and wants to learn about Buddhism. And so first the Zen master offers tea. And so the academic magician is holding the teacup and the tea master begins pouring the tea. And when it comes up to the brim, he keeps pouring the tea. And the professor says, wait a minute, it's full, you should stop. You know, no more tea will fit in. It's, you know, overflowing. And the Zen master says, well, in the same way, you're coming here overflowing. You're already full. How can I impart anything when you're already full of your own opinions and ideas and everything? So some ability to let go of maybe some of your preconceived ideas. Not absolutely, but enough to be willing to kind of take something in and hear something or learn something that might be new, might be a different perspective, to be challenged. And then the opposite of ill will is said to be loving kindness. So some attitude of kindness at the very beginning of the path. And the opposite of cruelty is compassion. So some cultivation of compassion. So it's hard to develop loving kindness and compassion. It's not an easy task. But it's like you're at least turning the ocean liner in that direction. Say, I'm going to try at least, as I engage in this practice, in this exploration, to try to do so that I'm a little bit kinder, at least to myself. A little bit more compassionate. And I know for many, many people, it's really crucial to have some degree of compassion and kindness, because as we sit down and kind of become more aware of what's going on, self-knowledge is sometimes bad news. More of you should have laughed at that. Maybe you haven't done enough self-reflection. So self-knowledge is often not good news. And so to hold that with kindness and compassion as opposed to the opposites is very, very important. And it hopefully makes the whole engagement of the Buddhist path something that you do kind of lightly. Hold it lightly. Hold it with kind of a lightness of being. You know, take it, you know, even though it's so important or so valuable, the potential we're trying to address in Buddhism, I think it's really important to hold it very lightly, not take it too seriously. When I was in the Zen monastery, I went up to my teacher once and said, something like, I'm not really taking anything so seriously anymore. But the thing I take most seriously is practice. And so I thought that was good. Maybe it doesn't sound very good, the way it's said. But I, you know, kind of, you know, and the context of saying it was I was a Zen monk. I was pretty intent. I was engaged. It wasn't like I was goofing off. But it was a likeness, you know, to holding everything. And in that likeness, the thing that I took most seriously was my practice. Even that was kind of lightly held. So the attitude that we take. And in the Metta Sutta, the Discourse on Loving Kindness, it opens up not by instructions on how to practice loving kindness. It opens up with instructions of the attitude to have. You should be someone who is easy to admonish, someone who lives simply, doesn't have a lot of things going on. The attitude is so important. And perhaps attitude is both difficult to adjust and also somehow easy. I think both are true almost simultaneously. you can kind of have the idea, oh, it'd be useful to be kinder here. Let me try that out. That's easy to have that idea. Maybe it's not so easy always to follow through, but to turn the ocean liner in that direction, to simplicity, some degree of letting go, appropriate letting go, and compassion. So then that's the overall, I think, the widest attitude that's helpful. And I think one of the widest attitudes that's helpful for raising a baby is love and compassion and care among those around. And then the next part of the path, next three steps, have all to do with our relationship to other people, our society, the society and people. And I think this is very, very crucial, that that somehow we're not kind of rushing in to meditate and go into this inner, deep inner life, but we're beginning to kind of, just like a child slowly develops to become independent, and only when they're a teenager or beyond starts living independently, or even discovers who they are. And a lot of the early years of growing up have a lot to do with what happens in society, in relationship to other people, and getting those relationships established, and hopefully in healthy ways. So I think that as we grow up in the Eightfold Path, it's very important to consider how we cultivate or develop ourselves in relationship to society and other people. And it's very easy to overlook that. And it's very easy to have, as adults, have ideas that, oh, I've already done that. I'm an introvert after all, so I don't really want to be involved with other people. I'm mature, to take other people into account is a little bit of, it's frightening, it's offensive, because I already think that I'm, great. And, but here at the beginning of the path, we're taking other people into account. And it's talked about in a particular way in the Eightfold Path, but I think it's important to expand it outward to include the kind of feedback we get from other people, how we take into account our impact on other people and their impact on us, and how we are custodian and caretaker for that impact and their relationship to others. So one of the things the Buddha said, taught, especially to his monks, who he felt he could teach this thing to, the Buddha was, I think, somewhat reticent to teach lay people because they hadn't entrusted themselves to him. But when he was teaching to monks, he would encourage them to cultivate themselves so that they were easy to admonish. Isn't that interesting? So you're easy to admonish. So it's easy to come up to you, your teacher or someone, and say, hey, when you speak, you don't seem to listen to other people very well. You seem constantly interrupting and kind of giving advice. Or when you speak, you realize that you often, it feels like gossip to me. You're often talking about other people in kind of harsh ways. Do you realize you do that? Or do you realize that you seem to always kind of think of yourself first? And even as something simple as how you put your shoes in the shoe rack, you just think, the best spot is always for you. And you don't notice the person behind you has a cane and limping and, has trouble getting there. Have you noticed how self-absorbed you are? I'm just making up examples here, but it could be a lot simpler things you could say. But are you willing to get feedback? And part of this, the social, the relational part of Buddhist training, is to let yourself be someone who's willing to get feedback. Not only willing, but invite feedback. And one of the reasons why this is so important is that other people can often see aspects of yourself that's difficult for you to see yourself. And if you want to speed along your own spiritual growth, it's really good to take everyone that you encounter as your teachers. Be willing to take them on, give feedback. Even when they're not telling you, directly, kindly, by the way, have you thought about this? They could just be really nasty and treat you nastily. There's an art to taking even nasty people as your teacher. It doesn't mean that you agree with them, it doesn't mean you go along with them, but it's like, oh, what's required of me now to not get nasty back? What's required of me to cultivate appropriate kindness and compassion in the situation? What's it like to me to not to let go of something that needs to be let go of in a situation? What's it like for me to develop the inner strength that I can meet this person and say no and respond in a strong, maybe even ferocious way? So what is it that, what's required in the situation? And to see, oh, what's the opportunity here? Take other people as your teachers and friends. Invite your friends to give you feedback. Even someone who was my teacher, Buddhist teacher, at some point in our relationship came up to me and said to me, can you be nice and be helpful if you can give me some feedback from time to time? We were in that situation, you know, and how did I do there? You know, what I said and what I did in that situation that you witnessed, what do you think of that? Was that, did I conduct myself well or something? And so even people who are teachers, you know, ask for feedback. And when I was in Green Gulch, there was a wonderful tea teacher, Japanese tea teacher named Nakamura Sensei. Old, venerated, old woman. And she looked really old. An old, you know, beautiful woman, tea teacher. And at some point, her tea teacher in Japan, who was even older, died. And so she went back to Japan to get a new tea teacher, because it was really important to always have a teacher. And she found someone who was 50 years younger than her. I don't know, quite a bit younger than her. And someone said, but you know, you could be his teacher. And she said, it doesn't really matter. It's important to have a teacher. Someone that you can talk to, someone who can give you feedback, someone who you can be accountable to. So, of course, intimate partners are sometimes really good teachers. Sometimes the most difficult ones, sometimes the best ones, because they know, you know, what you do and other people aren't watching. And so sometimes, you know, to allow a partner, a friend to be a source of feedback is really good. And then there's plenty of feedback we get, not directly, but just by paying attention and tuning in to how the people are reacting to what we say and do, and what the impact we have. And it's not meant to be moralistic, this thing, but rather it's so we can learn and find out what's really going on here, so that we can help support the awakening of a potential, of a possibility that, you know, I'd like to say is sacred. It's beautiful, really beautiful. It's, you know, we're trying to find something really beautiful and let it shine and come forth. So then the Eightfold Path has a lot to do with how we are together with others. And so we talk about one of the aspects of the social aspect of the Eightfold Path is cultivating right speech. So looking at how we speak and working on our speech, looking at what motivates our speech, what the impact of our speech is, in order to kind of begin to refine ourselves and find out, can we speak, can we come from, can we discover, can we tap into that which is beautiful, that which is pure, that which is, you know, compassionate and peaceful and free inside of us. The idea in Buddhism is that when you break the precepts and you speak in unkind ways, you're not really free. What is it like to come from your freedom? And so the second of the social parts of the Eightfold Path is right action, which is usually defined by the five precepts. But the five precepts are these mirrors. If you're about to kill, if you're about to steal, if you're about to do sexual misconduct, if you're about to lie, if you're about to intoxicate yourself, chances are that you're not really coming from the place of deepest authentic freedom inside of yourself. Chances are that the desire to freely drink or fornicate or whatever is not really coming from a place of freedom, it's coming from a place of being caught by desire or by fear or by aggression or some variety of different things. So to use the precepts as a mirror, to come up against the edge of them, feel you're about to do something and say, wait a minute, let me look at this. And can I come back? Can I use it as a mirror and stop and look back at myself and get back in touch with something which I feel is important and valuable, that I really know, but I forget it when I'm really busy and running around or feel stressed or something. And then right action, right livelihood, how we live our life is part of this as well, to look at that. So, you know, the theory I think here is that partly our social relationships are somehow easier to get feedback, easier to work with than there's more of a coarser feedback system than looking within. I like to think of it as concentric circles. And there's this home base, this beautiful home place in the middle. And so we start kind of, you know, getting to know the country we're in. And then we know the state, and then the county, and then the city, and then the neighborhood, and then we come home. So the country we're in is we're in the country of the right view, of having a sense of this potential that we have. And that puts us in the territory. And then that's the country and the state. We put ourselves into the attitude, the state of mind that we're going to be in. And so we kind of try to get to be in the right state. And then we come into the city, the county, the city, and the neighborhood. And then we're, you know, looking at right speech, right action, and right livelihood. So we're getting closer. All these things are supporting getting closer. And then at some point, we come close to home, or maybe in our, maybe not, we're not quite in our house yet, but maybe we're on our lot that the home is sitting on. And so we're getting really close. And so the last three factors of the Eightfold Path, we're finally getting close to home. And we can look at something that's much more personal, deep inside of ourselves, really about ourselves, our relationship to ourselves, what's going on, what motivates and moves us inside. And so this begins looking at our heart or in our mind, looking inward rather than outward. And so so in a sense, maybe the analogy of growing up chronologically in age, it's only when a person enters teenage years that I think a person has a really, really starts to having a real capacity of being inward and looking and seeing what beliefs they have, what motivates them. And so the same thing, after you do this other work, then for on the Eightfold Path, you begin looking within. So again, the reference point is always this potential of freedom, freedom from suffering, of peace, of happiness. And so the first of the inner parts of the Eightfold Path is called effort, right endeavoring. And the right effort is defined through having some sense of your potential. And so you have a sense of the potential for peace, the potential for this inner beauty. And then you move in the direction that supports that and move away from those things that don't support it within yourself. So the social conditions have been taken care of now. So what are the impulses inside of you? What are the motivations? What are the states of mind that arise in you which are not helpful to support the cultivation of this potential? If you have a sense of what's not helpful, then avoid them. Don't let them come up. Or if they do come up, learn how to let go of them. So, for example, if you have learned that being consumed by desire for things is not such a helpful state to be in, and that looking at consumer reports every month, you know, at least in a strange magazine, I think, because it's trying to encourage people to be consumers, I guess. Good consumers. So anyway, you look at consumer reports, and oh, that, like that, and that, and that, and that. And after reading consumer reports, you realize that the next 2 days, you're just kind of upset about how you can't afford all the things being offered there. And so you realize, maybe it's not so helpful for me to kind of keep going back to that kind of behavior, because that behavior produces a state of mind which is not helpful for me. So you're beginning to take responsibility for your inner state, your inner motivation, what drives you, what you get caught by, and making adjustments accordingly. So this is the right effort, learning to make those adjustments to what's helpful and what's not helpful. And because you have a standard to measure it against, some degree of your potential, your peace, your sense of love, settledness, being at home in yourself, you know, you have something to guide you with in this right effort, knowing what's helpful and what's not. Things that are helpful, you try to develop those things and you try to maintain those things. Then the next step is not just is even more intimate, more kind of coming in, closer to home. Maybe now you're in your living room. Maybe, I don't know what's in. And now we're, it's called the right concentration. And when the other things are kind of in place well enough, then it's a lot easier to get settled on yourself. If your relationships are not settled, it's very hard to be settled on yourself. So then, and if you don't know what your practice is about, the direction your life has, the real sense of purpose and meaning in your life, it's also hard to be settled on yourself. So the concentration then is this deep settling, keep composure. And so we begin then the practice of settling on ourselves in a more and more deep way. To really settle on yourself. Sometimes in Zen traditions, Zen meditation is called settling on oneself. So you're not spinning around, not ahead of yourself, not behind yourself, not in the future, not in the past, not trying to create a different self than who you are, but you're settling on yourself, being settled here. I like the word composure as a description of concentration. And so you're beginning to do this inner work now, really kind of working on the mind, the heart. And then the most innermost part of it all, close to the innermost part, you're getting really to the very heart of your home. It's not your living room, I don't know, it's the kitchen? I don't know what it is, but you come to the innermost part. And this is the practice of right mindfulness. And some people reverse it. Some people feel that right concentration is the heart. Some people feel, you know. But in our tradition, I think mindfulness is really at the heart because it's considered to be the final practice. And so right mindfulness is the ability to really pay attention to what's happening. Not just to be settled here, but to really look carefully. What is really going on in the deepest recesses of my mind, my heart? And in the deepest recesses of my heart, what are the things I most cling to? What are the things I most resist? What are the places that are most closed? What are the places that are most offended? What are the places that are most attached to something? And then to take that step of letting go, to let go of the resistance, letting go of the defensiveness, letting go of the attachments, letting go of the sense of self, to completely let go. And that's the fullest potential that we have in Buddhism is found through the complete letting go. If you let go a little bit, we say, you'll discover part of your potential. Let go a little bit, you'll discover a little bit of happiness. Let go a medium amount, you discover a medium amount of happiness. Let go fully, and you discover full happiness. So it's up to you how far you want to go. But that's this practice of mindfulness, concentration and mindfulness together, working together, that allows us to see, or the mind to find those places in the little corners or in the very cellar of the mind that something deep has to let go. And then the amazing thing, we get a sense of this, even before we get out to the cellar, for the house analogy, you start getting some intimation of a degree of well-being, of peace or happiness, contentment, being at homeness, that is not dependent on things in the world going the way you want them to go. It's not dependent on your health. It's not dependent on your relationships you're in. It's not dependent on your job you have. It's not dependent on having a home or not having a home. It's not dependent on having recreational opportunities. It's not dependent on, anything. And that is an amazing discovery. I call it a cornucopia. in a revolution. And revolutionary kind of switch, change in the mind. To have that sense that in orienting the mind towards a freedom that's not dependent on anything going the right way. Or going the wrong way. And so this is when you become, in the Eightfold Path, you become a full adult. You can stand on your own two feet. You don't need anything, support, anything else around you. But you can really be there fully and completely present and happy and at peace, regardless of the conditions, how they change around you. And they can change dramatically. I don't know how it is for people who grew up in the United States. I know I grew up a good part of my upbringing in Europe. And when I was growing up there in the 60s, 50s, 60s, World War II was so vivid in people's minds still. You know, the people I met would tell me stories of being in concentration camps or being in this and that and being shot or shooting people. And, you know, the war was so, you know, the evidence was around. And so I kind of grew up always, you know, kind of half expecting that things could change in that direction at any moment's notice. And I wouldn't be surprised if the United States The Soviet Union fell apart in our lifetime. I wouldn't be surprised if America fell apart in our lifetime. It seems unlikely. But I'm ready. So things can change radically, is what I'm trying to say. And even if they don't change in that kind of political way, they can change for you. And as you all know, I think, how quickly from one day to the next your life can change. One moment to the next, it can change completely and radically. So are you ready for that? When the Buddha was teaching his son meditation, when his son was about 14 or 15 years old, and was teaching him a process of meditation that deepened the capacity for a tremendous sense of well-being, discovery of this beauty inside of us, he offered this beautiful practice, and then he said basically something like, this is the practice that's going to help you to die peacefully. Isn't that something? To die at peace. To die being present for your experience. So the Eightfold Path is an offering, or is a path for how we can grow up to be spiritual adults. And many of you are well on the way. All of you are well on the way. I'm quite confident of that. And it doesn't hurt to start over again. So why don't you consider the Eightfold Path and see how it can become your own path. Not something that you take on from the outside, but how does it work for you? How does it come alive? What gives it? What's the appropriate expression of it for your life? So that the potential that you might feel you have can not just be a potential, but become an actuality. So that's an attempt to offer it, the Eightfold Path, in a little different perspective. Next week, I'm hoping you'll consider, think about this, be challenged by this over the week. I love it when people disagree with me. So then come back next week. I'll offer a little different perspective on the Eightfold Path as an introduction for the morning. But then we'll take questions and comments and discussion and see where we go with that. Good? Okay, thank you.